When we look around at the world in which we live, certainly there's some parts of it that isn't all that attractive. In some ways, we may think that even about the place where we live, here in this part of West Texas. And yet, even it has its own magnificence and uniqueness and grandeur. Certainly, for like David and Sandra and for others who have either had the opportunity or have been given the job by our government to travel all over the world practically. They and we, by means of magazines like National Geographic or television programs like Discovery Channel or others such as that, can see some of the wonder and majesty, the beauty, the grandeur that exists in our world. To stand on the edge of the Grand Canyon and just try to fathom what you're seeing. Even stand here in West Texas and watch a red sunset with the clouds interspersed with the blue sky. To see video of the animals running on the plains of Africa. To see the pictures that are sent back from space, from the probes and the telescopes and the space station that man has all put into space. To even see pictures greatly magnified of microscopic life. It's amazing. It's incredible. Originally, the purpose of science, and hopefully fundamentally still the purpose of science among the studies of man, is to examine and catalog and try to understand all of this, whether it's biology or astronomy, whether it's chemistry or geology. Whatever field of science it might be, it's all focusing on this majestic, wonderful creation from God. And what's true of our physical world around us, we also are often encouraged, maybe way beyond encouraged, inspired, and touched by the great things that sometimes people can do. I don't mean like walking on the moon or something, inventing some new device, but I'm talking about the kind of charity, the kind of benevolence, the kind of sacrifice, the compassion or dedication that often can be shown by people. The Mother Teresa's of the world, the Mahatma Gandhi's, the so many others who have given their lives or part of their lives to better the lives of others. Even those who would give their own life to save the lives of others. We can be touched by that kind of majesty and grandeur as well. But then there's a stark contrast to that. We sort of understand that in our world, sometimes the same things that are so majestic also can be quite terrible. A hurricane, a tsunami, a tornado, an earthquake, a volcano, a blizzard. And the same things that in one context are so beautiful and majestic, in another can be so devastating and deadly. But perhaps the greatest contrast is not what happens again in our physical world, but what happens among the race called mankind. The incredible cruelty, the incredible inhumanity, the terrible, awful acts that can sometimes be done by some people upon others, the suffering that therefore people have to endure, and the individual depravity of the human heart and mind sometimes. And how are we to make sense of that? Great beauty and great destruction. Great charity and compassion and incredible cruelty and hatred. It's something that man in all of human history has sought to try to make sense of. These extremes exist together. How can, on the one hand, humanity rise to such great heights and yet at the same time sink to such depths? And this seeming paradox presents to us today another reason why the Bible still matters. For in all of human history, I would put forward to you today that only the Bible gives an adequate explanation of how these things can exist together. This is part of a series we're doing on why the Bible still matters. The Bible, as we believe to be the revelation from God Himself, makes it possible for us to make sense of our world. It helps us to understand where it came from, who made it, is there a God and what He is like, who are we, man, what is history all about, many other things that provides a suitable, reasonable answer to. And while man, separate and apart from the Bible, has often tried to find alternative explanations, often even purposely trying to find an answer the opposite to whatever the Bible says because they feel threatened by what it says, nevertheless, I still submit to you, and I still believe with all my heart, the Bible is the answer. The Bible is the answer to how man can be so great and yet so cruel. How some people can be so caring and sacrificial and giving, and others can be so hateful and cruel and incredibly dangerous in every kind of way towards their fellow man. Evolution and humanism's answer is, that's just evolution. Survival of the fittest. I refuse to accept the idea that what Adolf Hitler and his regime did is evolution, and that that can be justified on the basis that it was the survival of the fittest. That's how he justified it. I refuse to believe that. That is how man is evolving. Instead, I believe a far more reasonable explanation is what the Bible tells us. It's not only reasonable, but it's comprehensive in its explanation of it. And it does not seek to justify any one person or group of people's actions, either good or evil. And so today, I submit to you that the Bible still matters because the Bible tells us what is right and wrong. Now, I realize that's not an explanation for why there's earthquakes or tsunamis. That would be a discussion of why nature is the way it is. But rather, just in terms of the human realm and what we do to each other and what we do to ourselves, the Bible provides for us a clear explanation of right and wrong. Of right and wrong. It begins at the very beginning of the Bible. There, after we have the explanation of the creation of the world by God, and including the creation of mankind, the first two human beings that are focused on there, Adam and Eve, are put in a beautiful, wonderful place. And they're given instructions by God on what is right and what is wrong. They're told what to do and what not to do, even at that very beginning time. And they eventually broke the law of God. They disobeyed. It's at that same time we're introduced to another individual who is the one who leads this whole breaking of God's law movement. He's what comes to be known in the Scriptures as the devil, or Satan. He appears first in the form simply of a serpent or a snake. And yet he is there to encourage man to break God's law. And as we move through the Scriptures, we find that God gives specific, clear, understandable instructions about what is right and what is wrong throughout the Scriptures. And within the Scriptures themselves, we see these people who are the descendants of Abraham come to be called Israelites. And by our time today, we refer to them as the Jewish people. But here they are in the Old Testament, and God brings them out of Egypt, and He brings them to Mount Sinai. And what happens at Mount Sinai? God gives them His law. He spells it out. The anchor or the cornerstone of that law is something called the Ten Commandments. We read about in Exodus chapter 20. But it's much more than just the Ten Commandments. There's hundreds of other very specific commandments about how to treat other people, how to live together in a right way with each other. Things having to do with people's property, their lives, their conduct, their interaction with each other. And yes, even their conduct and interaction towards God. When we get to the New Testament, we find probably the most outstanding example of, if anything, an amplification and a clarification of this understanding of right and wrong in the Sermon on the Mount by Jesus in Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7, where he spells out what is right and what is wrong. None of this indication that right is what feels good and wrong is what makes you feel bad. None of this, everybody makes up his own rules. None of this, well, the situation dictates what you should do. When I first went off to college, the summer before I went for my freshman year, they notified all the incoming freshmen that every one of us had to buy a copy of a book called Situation Ethics and read it and be prepared during the first week of our first year on campus to discuss that. No situation ethics here. Clear, plain explanations of what is moral, what is ethical, what is right, and what is wrong. And even those people who may not know specifically about what God's law is, they may not yet know about the Bible or how God has spelled it out. The Scriptures even tell us that they have been provided by God with a conscience. The Scriptures tell us in Romans chapter 2 that while this conscience that every human being has is not infallible, that is, it is not 100% accurate, even so, it points man in the way of what's right. And if that's all a man knows, God will hold him accountable for that. And so we read in Romans chapter 2, and in verse 14 and 15, it says, "Indeed, when Gentiles who do not have the law do by nature things required by the law, they are a law for themselves, even though they do not have the law, since they show that the requirements of the law are written on their hearts, their consciences also bearing witness, and their thoughts now accusing, now even defending them." What Paul is describing here is, even in observing the world around him, even people who knew nothing about the law that God had given at Sinai, the instructions that came there, he still recognized that among the Romans, among the Greeks, among the barbarians, people fundamentally seemed to innately know that things like theft and murder and being cruel to other people is wrong. But that didn't keep people from doing it. But they acknowledged the right. And he says that was innate. It was by nature. It is what he calls their conscience. And we still recognize that today. But that's not enough. God knew that was not enough, even though he put that in us, because he gives us this clear, written, spoken, spelled out right and wrong law. The Bible still matters because it tells us what is right and wrong. The Bible still matters because it tells us that when we break God's law, we are guilty of something called sin. If there's any one word that the modern psychologist and psychiatrist does not want to use with their clients or patients, it's the word sin. And yet that's the word God uses to describe the breaking of His law. One of Jesus' apostles, John, says in 1 John chapter 3, and in verse 4, "Everyone who sins breaks the law. In fact, sin is breaking law." There's a clear, plain definition of what sin is. Along with the sin ought to come guilt. That is, the recognition, the acknowledgement that we've broken God's law. Now, the Scriptures are pretty clear that the whole human race is infected with sinfulness. This same John said back in chapter 1 and in verse 8, "If we claim to be without sin, we deceive ourselves, and the truth is not in us." So if we acknowledge that breaking God's law is sin, we also need to acknowledge the fact that sin is something that all humankind is guilty of. Back to Romans again, the other section where we've already been reading from. After Paul talks about the Jews having God's law and having broken it. He talked about the Gentiles who didn't know God's law but had a conscience. They had violated that conscience. Where's he going with that discussion? The very next thing he says, therefore we can conclude that all have sinned and fallen short. Romans chapter 3 is the first three-fourths of that chapter is all devoted to that very premise that all mankind have broken God's law. And we need to acknowledge that. So the Bible still matters because it helps us understand what sin is. It helps us understand what guilt is. It helps us understand that sin is a reality and it is something that has put us out of a right relationship with our Creator. It's not just a feeling we have because we're not better educated or we need to overcome, you know, or some of the modern pop psychology, how to get over your sense and feelings of guilt. Those are all wrong-headed and wrong-directed because they're simply trying to tell people that they just need to change their thinking. No, they need to change their actions. It's not just that we need to change our thinking about the wrong things we do. We need to change the wrong things we do. We need to acknowledge we've done wrong things. And while we reserve for next week the discussion of why the Bible still matters and how to deal with sin, what to do about our sin, what God has done to make it possible for us to deal with our sin, today we want to just say one more thing about why the Bible still matters. Not only does it still matter because it tells us what's right and wrong, and it still matters because it tells us about sin, it also matters because it tells us we're being held accountable by God, and that a day is coming in which a judgment will take place where men will have to give an answer for their sins. Again, that's not a popular idea, because it's not a comfortable idea. It's not a you can think yourself to being a better person idea. Instead, it says we have been guilty of something and we've got ourselves into a mess we can't get ourselves out of. And a day is coming when God will judge people for their sins. Now, first of all, that very idea of being held accountable for wrongdoing is again something that's built into our conscience. We have, Dr. Paul says in the book of Galatians chapter 6, we have this fundamental belief, and I think you find it everywhere among men everywhere, no matter how remote, no matter how primitive, how isolated they might be from the Bible or whatever, they have this idea that wrong ought to be punished and that right ought to be rewarded. Or as Paul says in Galatians chapter 6, he says, for what you sow, you will reap. That's a fundamental idea, not only of our conscience, but more especially a statement from the Scriptures. And so we'll read in passages about this coming judgment day. For example, Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, he will say in verse 10, for we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one may receive what is due him for the things done while in the body, whether good or bad. Or that great passage at the end of the book of Revelation. And while we're sometimes afraid to read very much in Revelation because we don't think we're understanding it, this is not a passage that falls in this category. People probably don't want to read this one because they do understand it. For it says in Revelation chapter 20, and then in verse 11, then I saw a great white throne and him who was seated on it. Earth and sky fled from his presence, and there was no more place for them. And I saw the dead, great and small, standing before the throne, and books were opened. And another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged according to what they had done as recorded in the books. I suppose some people think if they can get through life without having to face their sins and can die, they think they got away with it. This scripture tells us not so. For it says at the end of time, all people, great and small, dead and alive, will stand before God and be judged for what they've done. judgment. The Bible still matters because it tells us what is right and wrong. It tells us what is sin and where that guilt comes from. And it tells us we will have to answer to God for that. We have a hymn in our hymn books, not one we're going to be singing this morning, but it's one that always comes to mind to me when I read about or start thinking about the judgment. That hymn is called, "There's a Great Day Coming." There's a great day coming. It's a great day because it's the day in which God is finally going to sort it all out. And everyone will receive what is due them. Now it says in the book of Colossians chapter 1 that God has done something about sin. We couldn't. It's impossible for us to do something to sort of lift ourselves up by our own bootstraps. Now that we've gotten ourselves into this mess of having broken God's law and being held accountable to Him, and one day we'll stand before Him and answer for it. God did what we could not do. I've read somewhere where a man described what God is going to do as the cosmic rescue effort. And perhaps you'll understand that better next week if you don't already know what that means. But in Colossians chapter 1, Paul, talking to these Christians in the city of Colossae, says in verse 21, "Once you were alienated from God and were enemies in your minds because of your evil behavior." That's what sin had done for them. That's what it did for us too. It alienated us from God and made us enemies, in effect, because it put us willfully or unwillfully over on the side of the enemies of God who are fighting against Him and all that is right. He says, "But now He has reconciled you." It's not what we did, it's what He did. God found a way to make a reconciliation, to bridge that gap, to remove the alienation and the enemy status. "But now He has reconciled you by Christ's physical body through His death, to present you holy in His sight, without blemish and free from accusation." So God has done something to make it possible for us to be free from the guilt and accountability and the judgment and the punishment for our sins. We'll hear more about that next week, because the Bible still matters. It tells us what we could not otherwise know. It explains to us what we would otherwise not understand. And it gives us hope when otherwise we'd be hopeless. We have an invitation song. We always extend at the end of our lessons on Sunday morning an invitation for people to think about what has been said and what we've read from the Bible. And if any of us need to do something to be right with God while we have the opportunity, you can come and share that with us during this time, and we'll do all we can to help you. If we can help you in any way, please come while we stand up and sing the song.